With this hour with Michael Barra, we'll take your phone calls as we talk about Men in Black, the battle for and of Los Angeles, and other UFO stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're back with Mike Barra. We'll get to your calls as well. Mike, of everything you've investigated, which excites you the most? What topic?
Well, I know that. Well, no, I think honestly, it's the secret space program stuff. It's what does the Space Force have to do with it? Why was this created? What technologies are coming? I mean, I heard a rumor, and I wasn't going to really talk about it until my YouTube show on Wednesday, but I heard a rumor that wormhole technology has effectively been discovered. And it's going to be, which means we can travel faster than light effectively from star to star. And that it will be announced later this year, but it will be just something that will come out. It'll be stated once. And anybody who wasn't paying attention at the time is not gonna catch it. But that's really exciting. And if that's the kind of thing we have in our future, now that we have a Space Force, I'm really looking forward to what else they're gonna tell us and what else they're gonna put out there.
What do you think of the plans for a Space Force?
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting stuff. I'd love to work for them. I'd love to be a press officer, public relations officer for them, because one of the things I'm really good at, George, I mean, the only skill I think I really have is I can take really, really complicated, complex technical stuff and break it down and make it simple for people. And I think that, it's just a fledgling organization at this point, but I think it's going to stick. And I think it's something that's desperately needed. And it obviously there's an ulterior motive. I mean, there's something more to the Space Force concept than simply, oh, well, we need to have an official organization. I mean, I think they're going to pull some really, really fascinating stuff from the deep black world, and we're going to start seeing things that we never thought we would ever see in our lifetimes.
To the phones we go. Let's go to George in Duluth, Minnesota, first-time caller. Hi, George. Welcome.
Well, hello. Yeah, this is kind of unrelated, but back during 9/11, there was a lot of stuff that kind of got glossed over. For example, the Air Force was told to stand down four different times, and there was accounts on the ground of the second plane that went in didn't have any windows on it, so it was a commercial airliner. And it's the big people say, well, what our government had something to do with that, and they go, why is that? It was a reason to go to war, and then we end up going to the Iraq war and a lot of that stuff.
Okay, let's keep you on topic, as we're with Mike Barra talking about UFOs. But I will say one thing about the plane without windows: they were all told to pull their shades down. And from afar, it looks like the plane has no windows.
Yeah, and the other thing too, George, is that's not the stand down order thing is not true. There were nine people in the room, including Condoleezza Rice with Dick Cheney, and what that actually concerns is that there was another plane. The plane, I think it was Flight 75, that crashed in Pennsylvania, and the orders were that go up and shoot down any planes that are headed toward Washington when they should all be grounded. And in fact, they didn't even have time to arm the planes that they did get up in the air. And so the pilots would have had to literally commit, suicide by crashing their own plane into the commercial jetliner to keep them from hitting. And when somebody came into the room and told Cheney that there was, in the bunker in the White House, and told Cheney that there was another plane coming in from Pennsylvania towards the Capitol, they asked him what to do, and he did not say stand down. He said the orders stand, and there are eight people that reported that. One person says he said stand down. I don't, again, there are a lot of these 9/11 myths. They really get under my skin because they're just not true.
Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Hey there, Eric.
George!
We missed that.
This is Eric, the mind control guy. How's everybody doing tonight?
My audiologist said that if you do that to me one more time, I'll go deaf.
I try to tone it down.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, I got a couple questions for the guest. One, as far as the Men in Black go, of course, several months ago I told you about my encounter with the Men in Black. And my question is, Is there any historical record or any kind of other urban legends where the Men in Black have threatened elected officials like congressmen, senators, mayors, governors, presidents, vice presidents, in particular former astronauts like John Glenn? And the other question is there any historical record of the Men in Black shadowing Val Thor, who is allegedly from the planet Venus?
Wow. Okay. Well, in terms of the astronauts, no, there hasn't ever been an astronaut that said I was threatened or intimidated by, you know, Men in Black or by people that might have been
right.
government agents.
Edgar Mitchell never said that to you or me.
No. And you know, there have been things where, you know, John Glenn, when he did his famous appearance on the Frasier TV show, where, you know, there's a scene where everybody leaves the room and John Glenn's left alone with the microphone and he starts talking about how he lied to the American people and NASA lied to the American people and all that stuff. He was never suppressed from doing that kind of thing. So I think a lot of the astronauts kind of did. They got the message out in subtle ways that had to do with their secrecy oath. In terms of congressmen and presidents and senators, I've never ever heard that story. Although I've heard some pretty wild stories about, you know, political encounters with extraterrestrials, but I've never heard anything specific about the Men in Black.
How about Val Thor, who apparently came from Venus?
Val Thor, Valiant Thor, that's a story. Again, I don't know what to make of that story. I think there's other people in the community that are more up on that particular story. I'm not sure that it's legit, but as far as I know, he had no encounters with the Men in Black. And if they were extraterrestrials and he was an extraterrestrial too, I would think it would be pretty hard to intimidate him because he did, according to the stories, he disseminated so much information to our government and to other people. And I mean, he seemed like a pretty connected guy. So I kind of doubt they could have got to him.
Somebody mentioned, was at UFOCon in San Francisco this weekend as well, Mike, and somebody mentioned to me that Val Thor from Venus is still around.
That's
kind of a neat story.
That's perfectly believable. You know, I don't know if you remember the late Bob Dean. By the way, can I also mention
I do remember him.
The late Jose Escamilla, who was going to do a movie about the Battle of Los Angeles before he passed away. So that's something that feels like it's incomplete. There's still a documentary out there to be made. But Bob Dean told me once, and he used to say this in his lectures, you know, extraterrestrials are not involved with the government. Extraterrestrials are the government. I'm like, oh, come on, Bob, name me one extraterrestrial in the government. And he gave me the name of a general, a guy that was the head of the U.S. Space Command. He was, I believe he was a Brigadier General Lance Lord. And I looked the guy up, and he said, you know, Bob told me, you know, he's 76 years old and he looks like he's 56, and he did. And, you know, he said that there were people like Val Thor. And here's the other thing, too, is the guy looked a little bit like Valiant Thor. I mean, he was a blonde, you know, big Nordic looking kind of guy.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that he's still here. And also, don't forget that Zechariah Sitchin, you know, when he wrote his book, The Lost Book of Enki, which I talked about this in my book, Ancient
Aliens. Which was his last book, wasn't it?
Right, right. I talked about this in Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies, and it's, quote, historical fiction. But according to people that knew Sitchin, what he said is that, no, it wasn't, he wrote it as a fiction, as a novel, so he could get away with it. But actually, all the information came from Enki, came from the Sumerian god Enki, who he said is still here trying to fix all the bad karma that he and his, you know, than the Anunnaki created way, way back hundreds of thousands of years ago, so that they're still alive. And if the whole story about the Anunnaki is true, then that seems plausible. So we may have a lot of people, you know, from some of these famous figures may still be here. It'd be kind of fun to have a conference with them sometime, wouldn't it?
It would. That'd be cool. Walter in Pennsylvania, take it away, Walt.
Hi, George.
Hey, Walter.
It was good to hear Tom's voice again. I told him I got to talking to Don and Gina so much, I almost feel like I'm married to them. So, George, about 10 years ago, I remember seeing it was either on History Channel or PBS, where the Japanese did have a semi-secret program where they would launch balloons laden with incendiary bombs and they took advantage of the prevailing winds blowing from west to east across the Pacific. And from what I understand, the idea was to set the great forest fires in Washington State, Oregon, Northern California, British Columbia.
Sure.
And George, I remember as late as the 1990s, there was a family of campers, and they stumbled upon one of these old 50-year-old Japanese incendiary bombs, and they were, a number of them were, if I'm not mistaken, they were killed or seriously injured by it.
I don't think they were killed. It may have detonated, but I'm not sure they were killed. I'm pretty sure they weren't.
It was definitely in the news.
Yeah, but you're right about the Japanese launching those kinds of bomb balloons, hoping that they would just land somewhere and just create terror.
Yeah, and George, on the East Coast, there, if I'm not mistaken, there was shots exchanged off the coast of New Jersey with German U-boats.
That's true. Mike Barrow, do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. And, you know, the thing is that the incendiary bombs, that was a real thing. It didn't really work. I'm amazed they made it as far across the Pacific as they did.
And, me too.
And balloons were a factor that night. I mean, there were some balloons that were put up. Apparently, they were put up before the alert. They were simply weather balloons that were put up. You know, the old weather, here we are again, George, with the old weather balloon.
Here we go. Right? That's right. Roswell all over again, right?
Right. But there were only a couple of them. And actually, you know, my information, and I really can't go into where I got this from, but it is that actually this object was German, not German technology. It was actually extraterrestrial technology, which was being demonstrated for the Germans, because the race involved was going to make a deal with the Germans to help them technologically in return for certain things that the Nazis were willing to give them, and that's what was behind this whole thing. It was basically a demonstration, not only to it was a test of our defenses and our capabilities, and also to demonstrate to the Germans that they were invulnerable and couldn't be dealt with. So that's a wild story, but you know, I mean, this is our community, and we deal with a lot of wild stories in it. I just have heard from a couple different sources that this is really what happened.
In 1942, weren't we also quietly working on the atomic bomb?
Very quietly and very much at the very beginning, and so were the Nazis, and they would have needed help. And but, you know, it's interesting. For as advanced as they were, many of the things that they had, all these amazing aviation technologies and really the potential of hyperdimensional technologies like the Nazi Bell and so forth, these were super advanced, way more advanced actually than the atomic bomb. But you know, they didn't really ever get them developed or deployed in time to make a difference in the war. But you know, again, don't forget that Hermann Oberth, who was actually Wernher von Braun's mentor, he's the guy who sponsored him for his engineering degree and all that stuff, said flat out that we were able to make all these advancements in space and science and technology because we had help. And they asked him, help from who? And he said, the people of other worlds. And at AlienCon a couple of years ago with Eric von Daniken, he confirmed that story because he had Oberth as a guest at his hotel back in Switzerland before he was Eric von Daniken. And he said he flat out asked him. And for the second time, Oberth repeated, yeah, we had help from aliens.
And didn't Oppenheimer, who created the atomic bomb, get the idea from ancient India Sanskrits?
Yeah, he did. And he actually quoted quoted from them when he saw the explosion at Trinity, the Trinity test. You know, I think it was, I am become death, the shatterer of worlds, which is actually from those Sanskrit texts. So he was a big student of those. And the thing is, George, is nobody really knows how they figured out critical mass. You know, you have to have critical mass to create a nuclear detonation, and you have to have exactly this right amount of enriched uranium, and you have the whole plutonium plug that pounds into it to create the explosion. And, you know, that was the big problem that nobody could solve. And somehow, some way, we solved it, or did we? Because remember, if you look at the work of people like Dr. Joseph Farrell, he argues that those two bombs we dropped on the Japanese were actually built by the Germans and never used. So who knows the true history of all this stuff?
Next up, let's go to Ed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Edward, take it away.
Hey, George.
Heidi.
That was a great idea. I guess you'll save that clip from the guy that was 5 years old.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You mentioned Mothman a minute ago, Mike, and I'm going to tell you a quick story about that and ask you one quick question about Mars. I didn't know anything about Mothman. And I don't know, a handful of years ago, as you can probably tell from my hillbilly twang, I'm in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And up towards the mountains, as you head that way, there's been quite a few sightings, apparently, and I didn't know this, but they were interviewing a girl, and she said when she was 16, like 5 years earlier or something, she was leaving, you know, her house and going up the little road, and up in the trees off the road, it caught her attention, and she described what was a Mothman up in the tree, a giant thing with the wings. And she told her family, and she got teased by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Always. And 3 or 4 years go by, and so she's 21 or whatever, and so her boyfriend picks her up early one morning to take her to work, and it's dark. And the headlights show somebody standing by the road, and he has her pull over, and he gets a flashlight out of the glove compartment and starts going towards it, and then kind of freaked out. The thing had these big wings and stuff. He thought it was a cape or a coat, and he runs back and gets in the car, and they take off, and she said that the thing went up in the air and came down and hit the top of the car, and they had the station wagon and had scratch marks. And her boyfriend, she said he was shaking and said, I'll never tease you again.
Yeah.
And
did it have the glowing red eyes that are as often described with the Mothman? Did it have those glowing
eyes? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I had forgotten that. So I Google Mothman, and there's even a nice-looking statue of one in some town, but I didn't know anything about them. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you your thing about Mars. Is it true there's a Sphinx on Mars, as far as you know? I was interested.
Yeah, I wrote about that really extensively, it was discovered by a guy named Giuseppe Pizzella, who was looking at Pathfinder images of the Pathfinder landing site from the late 1990s. And, you know, there's what they show us, George, and then there's the real pictures, and I'm sure they've got some really incredible real pictures of this Sphinx. But there's these two mountains near the Pathfinder landing site, which are commonly called the Twin Peaks. And if you look at the Twin Peaks and you work with it under enhancement, you can plainly see what appears to be layered artificial constructs like condos on both of these mountains. And right in between them is this object that looks for all the world like, from a distance, like an Egyptian Sphinx. And it's interesting because it's right in a position where it would effectively be guarding these two pyramids, and just like the Sphinx guards the pyramids at Giza. And it's really incredible to look at. Now, when we got Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter images of that particular area, it was really disappointing because right where the Sphinx should be, there's just this sort of gray blob, and it looks like somebody at NASA took an airbrush tool and just wiped it out. But, you know, I've seen this thing. I looked at Giuseppe's work. I did my own work on it. I put it out there. I think most of the pictures you see out there are actually mine that I developed. And I would say, yeah, there is a Sphinx that's about the right size, position, and place on Mars to be kind of the same functional Sphinx.
There's definitely something there. Mike, we're going to come back and take final calls. And, of course, that statue of Mothman is at Point Pleasant, West Virginia. On our next Coast to Coast program, Jared Murphy joins us to talk about his work, It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History. And that is something I'm looking forward to. And welcome back. Mike Bearer with us, our final segment, and your phone calls as we talk about all things UFO and space. Mike, how did you, as a aerospace engineer, designer, consultant, get involved in UFOs?
I was born this way, George.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
I
was interested in aliens from the time I can remember anything. I mean, you know how the caller Bob talked about how, you know, 5 years old is about when you start to remember stuff, and my first memories are watching black and white TV of rocket launches, of Gemini missions,
sure,
and, you know, and all that stuff. I don't remember anything earlier than that, but, you know, I was always interested in space and aliens, and then a Star Trek and Lost in Space came along, and that was just it for me, and I always have been, and it wasn't until
you know, I started winding down the engineering thing that I decided, well, I guess now I can afford to go out and kind of, you know, focus more on my interest and make it more than just a hobby and really start, you know, going into it. And that's all that happened. I just, really, I'll tell you the truth. I was at work one night at a major aerospace corporation. It used to be based here in the Pacific Northwest. And next thing you know, some people were running a video of some guy talking about the face on Mars, and it just took off from there. That was about 1998. And then, of course, I was working late at night, so I was able to listen to Coast AM on the way home, and that just got me all riled up.
Super, super. By the way, I've got a picture of the original Mercury 7 astronaut sign. What do you think that's worth?
Oh, well, I don't know. You'd have to ask the guys on Pawn Stars, but I think it's worth quite a bit. You know, I was surprised. I had a picture given to me by my friend Dr. Ken Johnston, which was actually a flag that had been to the moon on Apollo 15 signed by Jim Irwin. And it was worth, I don't know, $3,000, $4,000. So, I don't know. It just depends on if you catch somebody who wants that, right?
That's what it comes down to. Let's go back to the phones. Mike in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, you're on with Mike Barra.
Hey, good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I'm very glad that Tom Danheiser is back. I was praying for him, and we're all the Coast to Coast family is very happy he's back. So I just wanted to say that.
He's fought off his cold.
A couple of comments. First of all, I heard you mention earlier about being in, I assume, Boulder earlier this weekend and seeing Ancient Aliens on TV. And I just want to say the power and the reach of television is really something. It's really amazing. I just was watching the Science Channel a few weeks ago and saw one of our good former favorites, Jim Mars.
Oh, I miss
talking
him.
About ancient geography.
Yep.
Yeah. But it's really amazing the reach that television has. But Mike, I'm a big fan of your work. I did have a comment about one of our favorites, I think, Jason Martell, wrote a great book about how where aliens really come from, if they could come from space, the moon, where in the universe they come from. And I wanted to get your opinion on that. Thank you.
Well, they can come from lots of places. I mean, obviously, other planets that are like this one is very important. They do, you know, can travel here in extraterrestrial craft or use, you know, the wormhole technology to jump a big mothership, and they send out a bunch of scout ships and stuff like that. I think one of the more interesting answers is, of course, there's people that talk about interdimensional beings. They talk about them not necessarily existing in this plane, but sometimes I think that that's just a kind of a misinterpretation of some of their technology, that, you know, that you tend to experience them in that sort of ethereal realm, and you don't really think that they're necessarily physically in the room with you. But I think one of the more interesting ideas that really hasn't been addressed is they could come from inside the Earth. I mean, how do we know they haven't always been here? How do we know that many of these species weren't here actually before us, before this became our planet? And they could be living under, you know, under the oceans and in the interior of the planet. Lake Michigan, there's all kinds of weird sightings of ships coming in and out of Lake Michigan. So, you know, who knows? But I think it's the answer is probably all of these different ideas, because there are, I think, you know, it appears that there's many, many, many different species that are visiting the planet right now.
Indeed, indeed. Let's go back to the calls. Andy's with us in California. Go ahead, Andy. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, George. You're a great patriot, and really enjoy your program, and Mr. Barra.
Thank you.
I'm going to go back to 1992. This was the year of the Rodney King riots. What happened was I went going to Illinois to visit my mom for the last time, and she had open-heart surgery. And I'm stopped off in Flagstaff, Arizona, long story made short, sit down, order some coffee. And the young waitress, I'd say she was 20, 21 years old, very young, related a story that happened to her that happened back like 4 or 5 years earlier. She had told me that she went to visit a childhood playground in the National Forest there outside of Flagstaff. located at A1 Mountain Road. And she had told me that when she went back to visit the spot with her father, that two large male figures in camouflage fatigues with hoods on, all you could see is the slits for the eyes, but nothing for the mouth. And what she told me was they appeared virtually out of nowhere and told her when she was looking around the area and trying to reminisce in the past, she said that they had told her that she has to leave in a mechanical voice. And when the girl told her, said, "Hey, I'm just visiting. I'm not doing nothing wrong. I'm just visiting my childhood playground here." And one of the two male figures turned in a mechanical motion, not in a human way, and turned to the other and then looked back at her and said, "Leave or something terrible or something bad's going to happen to you." So she ran back to her dad's truck, or car, I should say, and she turned around one last time, and they were gone. Mm-hmm. And they were both carrying rifles. Okay. Now, the voice, she said, sounded like it was synthesized. It did not sound like a human voice, but it gets better. This is how the story concludes. When she gets home that week, unusual things started happening. Things were starting to disappear from her home that they were renting in the Flagstaff area, not far. And she said that not only were things disappearing, but within that first week, there was her dog came up dead, and then there was a message on paper that said, "You must leave, you must move from here, or something's going to happen to you." And what happened was she was terrified. Her father was terrified because the animal dying under mysterious circumstances, it really spooked her. And she said that the note had the infinity sign. It was signed with an infinity sign, as George and yourself, Mr. Barrow, would probably know what that is. So I came back after visiting my mom for 1 month, went back to the restaurant. It was a Denny's restaurant right off the interstate highway, probably still there. And I asked the girl, I said, "You remember me?" She said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Were you telling me the truth? Were you actually telling me the truth? Or are you exaggerating or making up this story?" She said, "I swear I'm telling you the absolute truth." And she looked like she was scared, right? When she related the story the first time, and she was willing to talk about it. So I said, "How do you get to that location again?" And she wrote it down, A1 Mountain Road. It's the Flagstaff National Forest there. And I said, "I got to see this from my own eyes." On the way back to California, I stopped over there and I got the spookiest feeling. And I'm not exaggerating, and I'm a Vietnam veteran. I have the feeling that I was under observation, remotely being observed. And that place, even some of the people that were there alongside the road, didn't seem like they were quite normal acting, you know, behaving quite like us. So I'm not surprised by that story that you related earlier about animals things happening to them. And I swear the story is 100% true. I'm not exaggerating or making it up. So just to add to what you had said earlier, Mr. Bear, and thank you.
All right, thank you. That is a great story, Michael.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, it seems like that if they have facilities or something in certain areas, it doesn't seem likely they would still be there years and years and years later. But sometimes, you know, the residual vibe can still be there. And I mean, when you get a feeling like that, you should trust it, because it's your instinct telling you that, you know, you're in an alien environment. I mean, I remember I've had two UFO sightings in my life, and in both cases, it wasn't like I saw something and got this creepy feeling. I got a creepy feeling and then I saw something. So, you know, I mean, I think we have kind of a sixth sense when things are not right, or something that's not supposed to be there is near us. So I'm glad he kind of heeded his
instincts and got out of there.
Ron is with us in North Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hello, Ronald. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, George. How are you? And Mike Barra, it's an honor to speak to you. I'm 68 years old. I got a long story, but I'm going to focus on the Men in Black portion of the story.
Sure.
I was in it from 1970 to 74. I was in a Coast Guard. I was a Raymond aboard a Coast Guard cutter. And we had seen a UFO, took telephoto pictures of it and everything. And so as we were coming back in, we're docking at my home port in Governor's Island, New York, Yankee Pier. And if there's three duty things you're getting ready. If you're not on duty, you get to go on vacation, on liberty, which means you get to go fly home. So we're all ready to go, and we're looking out, and here comes these three black limos up onto the pier, which never, ever happens. And peculiar. We're looking at them, and these about six men in black get out of the, and back in 1978, 70, this was from either 71 or 73. When this happened, I never heard of Men in Black. That wasn't even a coined phrase. So these six or seven guys get out of this. They got the black hats, the dark sunglasses. They all look alike. They're all walking down, and they're coming up on the ship, which is never ever happens either. They're coming on board, and next thing you know, we're told that you cannot. Our mess deck was one deck below. And he says, everybody had to go down, and they're going to be interrogated. You have to go downstairs. And so we go down there. It turns out we're being interrogated by, I stood right in front of a man in black. Where, I could have touched him. And we're being interrogated. Each one of us had to be interrogated. They made us sign affidavits with our names, social security numbers, service numbers, the whole thing, that you never saw nothing. And if you go and went, and I'll tell you, you want to know what they're like. I don't know. I would describe them as not the caters. Their skin was pale, but it looked normal, but it was palish color. They had dark sunglasses on. They had dark hats. Well, I'll think to myself later, why would you wear that? You're hiding something. So they didn't want you to see their eyes. They didn't want you to see their heads. Mm-hmm. So when they talked to you, it was in a monotone, robotic type of, no expressions whatsoever. And they said, you will not use this, not see nothing. You will sign this or you will not get off the ship. And so they forced us to sign this. And I was kind of brash about it. And I thought, yeah, right. And they told me directly this guy told me directly, he says, if you go to the news media, if this story gets out, nobody will ever find your body again.
Well, that's a great story, Mike. The clock's ticking, but they're everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah, they are everywhere. And above us, below us, in front of us. Sometimes lurking around in black hats and black suits.
Indeed, indeed. Website, where do people track you, Mr. Barra?
MikeBarra.blogspot.com. And, of course, you can find me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, places like that.
Ancient Aliens and JFK?
Ancient Aliens and JFK is one of it's my favorite book. It's the one I'm lecturing about the most. And I also have a book out on the Bermuda Triangle, called The Triangle. So go pick up that one and... let's see what people think about what's going on there.
And what are you working on now, Michael?
Absolutely nothing. Actually, no, I have.
This is a first for you, then.
I'm not working on another book. I just want to take a break, and I have some other things that I'm kind of waiting to see how they develop. But I've got some cruises and a bunch of lectures coming up, so I'm looking forward to all that stuff.
Excellent. Well, you take care and you keep in touch with us, okay?
Thank you, of course.
Mike Barra, he is one-of-a-kind expert on Men in Black, you name it. He's one of the best. And, of course, he wrote a book with Richard Hoagland years ago called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, and that is still well-read by a lot of people, indeed. I wanted to mention our YouTube channel. It's free to subscribe. Just simply go to YouTube.com in the search bar, put in Coast to Coast AM Official and sign up for the free YouTube channel. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We're everywhere these days, on Instagram as well. We've got a free newsletter for you that you can subscribe to. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lotifser, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.